why so much of this country's in the crapper? You're listening to it right there. This one happens to be out of Texas. These mind control centers that are... it would even embarrass the Jews if they had anything to do with this. Yeah, and this lady evangelist, bitch evangelist, in a big hall with 1,000 people in there, and they're all jumping up and down, and they're waving their arms, and then they get in single file, and come up and put the money in the pot, baby. Now you know why Texas went to hell fast. It wasn't the Mexicans that destroyed Texas. It was Christianity. Yes, it was. And it's doing it all over the place. Because they're teaching these people to turn the other cheek, baby. Yeah. Well, this is Terrible Tommy. And I'll get you on to something pretty good here. I think you'd rather listen to me than that stuff. September the 24th, 2014, here in the Midwest with not a cloud in the sky. It's beautiful sun out there. It's going to go up into the 70s today, and it couldn't be any better weather. That's right. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations and your donations for the radio show. Send your snail mail there, and if you have any problems with getting the show or anything like that, either contact old Tommy here or merchandiseresist@yahoo.com, the webmaster, and we'll work it out for you, baby. You know, it's unbelievable how much of the radio and TV spots, stations, networks, are taken up 24 hours a day by these raving maniacs, these Christ insanity people. I mean, on my FM radio here in north central Indiana, there must be about 7 or 8 of these Christ insanity programs going 24 hours a day. 24 hours a day. Don't forget, this is all tax exempt. It's every bit of it. $500-600 billion racket a year in this country, at least. And there's no taxes paid on it. None of that money goes back into the community. Very little of it goes out to feeding poor people. But a whole lot of it's going across the ocean into the dark holes and pits of squalor in Africa and India and Pakistan and all that, and all these missionaries going over there and spending all their time, but they're being supported by John Q. White Public, giving them the money. So anyhow, you wonder why we got a big problem in the white race? Well, we can talk about the Jews all we want, and there's sure a lot of truth to that. But I submit to you that Christianity is doing much more harm now than the Jews are able to do. And I'll debate anybody on that subject. Well, before I get too frothing at the mouth here and coming unglued, I'm going to go, I believe, to our last show, last series on history, the nonsensical history of war, especially when it has to do with the white race, where we've actually never won a war. And when you consider all the millions of white people who have died literally for con men politicians, con men presidents, set up, put up fake wars and so forth like that. And if we had not been involved in all those wars, to start adding up how many white people would have been in the gene pool. And you see the same thing today. This morning, the Presidente, our black president, got on the TV up there at the UN. I love it the way he's got those invisible glass folders out there that he can look at, and he's reading the speech, but he makes it look like it's extemporaneous. It's phony, it's a $3 bill. But it's amazing how you say, we're fighting terrorism and all over the world, and we're going to bring peace and prosperity. No, we're not bringing peace and prosperity. Your government is bringing warfare, torture, and death by the millions. And it's coming to our shores. Yes, it is. And now they're busy right now scaring everybody. See, before you can get people into a phony war, you got to scare the shit out of them. Something's got to happen. Every one of these wars that I talked about in the history of these wars, there was usually one big item that happened. You know, whether it was the Maine, sinking of the Maine in Havana Harbor, whether it was the Lusitania in World War I, whether it was the Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam, whether it was 9/11 for the Iraq War and all that. They always have to have something big and nasty happen. And there's always a buildup. They're out there. They're going to get you. They're coming through the border like mad. They're everywhere. Be afraid. Be afraid. Be afraid. Fuck you. I'm not afraid. And I'm not about to get afraid. You're the ones that should be afraid. Because when the shit hits the fan, we're coming for you, baby. We're coming for you. I'll guarantee you that. Well, let's get to our last in the series here of history and the phoniness of war and the horribleness of it is to the white race, and that's the First World War. Okay? World War, the first one. We shall not undertake a long discussion of the causes of the World War, but simply examine the reasons for the participation in it of the United States on the side of the alleged Allies. For the first time in history, the generation living through a great war has been able to ascertain the facts regarding its origin. These facts, however, have not yet become common property of the great masses, although they are gradually becoming evident to everybody. A great many people are still influenced by the passions and hatreds aroused by the conflict. Briefly stated, the causes of the conflict were trade rivalry between Great Britain and Germany, the scramble for territory, especially in Africa, the conflict between Russia and Germany for the domination of the Balkan Peninsula, and the old inherited animosity between France and Germany. The accusation of soul guilt against Germany is held no longer by persons who have studied the facts, although there still are and will no doubt always be differences of opinion about minor points. The immediate occasion for the opening of hostilities in 1914 was the murder of Archduke Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of the Austria-Hungary Empire. This murder took place while he was in Bosnia. Interesting how throughout history Bosnia and Serbia come up. The crime was committed by representatives of a pan-Slavic organization working hand-in-hand with the Serbian government with a view to annexing Bosnia to Serbia. Up to the 19th century, the Balkan Peninsula was owned by Turkey. But the last century had witnessed the gradual breakup of European Turkey on the Balkan Peninsula. In connection with this disintegration, Russia tried to gain territory at the expense of Turkey. Austria-Hungary also tried to penetrate the same area. The conflict was inevitably a consequence. Now, see, this is never really to better the people. It's to steal real estate. It's always the boys at the top wanted to steal more real estate. This Balkan problem had been a source of trouble in Europe for a century. The people of Serbia were Slavs and looked to Russia for support. In fact, Serbia was practically governed by Russian diplomacy. Seems similar to what's going on today. Austria-Hungary looked to Germany for support. In 1908, Bosnia, which was then a Turkish province, had been administered by Austria-Hungary since 1878, was annexed by Austria-Hungary. This act offended the Serbia, who wished to annex it as part of the Pan-Slavic dream for domination by Russia of Bosnia, Serbia, and the remainder of the Balkans. Here again, want more real estate. We gotta have more real estate. This annexation by Austria-Hungary defeated the Pan-Slavic dream and was a victory for Pan-Germany. Feeling became more and more acute when in 1914 Archduke Ferdinand was killed. The incident was applauded by Serbia, and the conflict followed. The details of the events in 1914 are too complicated to go into for our brief space, but popular accounts reaching the United States were from Allied sources and were correspondingly biased. In 1914, all Europe was divided into two great military camps, the Allied and Central Powers. The following is the size of the principal armies of Europe in 1914. Germany's army was 806,000. Austria had 370,000. Italy had 305,000. France had 818,000. Russia had 1,284,000. Belgium had 280,000. All Europe was equipped as a military machine, and the murder in 1914 simply put the machine in motion. It was an absurd fallacy to think that Germany was the only armed nation at the time, and to believe that Great Britain entered the conflict to defend Belgium is equally absurd. As early as 1911, Great Britain had made plans with France for marching an army through Belgium to Germany. In the event of war with Germany, Belgium was regarded as part of the Allied powers. Great Britain has officially acknowledged to be false in her ostensible reasoning for entering the war. The protection of Belgium. How many times have we heard that crap? Her reason was a struggle between rival imperialisms, which secret treaties later exposed and show clearly. However, we are concerned here only with why the United States entered the war. The three outstanding causes were interference with the neutral trade, economic ties with the Allies, and Allied propaganda in the United States. These causes overlap in such a way as to make it impossible to discuss them separately. Soon after war was declared in 1914, Great Britain placed mines in the North Sea and, with the aid of her Navy blockade, blockaded Germany and the adjacent neutral portions of North Europe. As a result, all goods going in that direction were captured. The United States protested, but Great Britain refused to yield the point, claiming it to be a military necessity, albeit illegal from the point of the view of international law. Great Britain blockaded Germany by mines and cut off all foreign trade with Germany and neutral ports near Germany to prevent the entrance of goods into Germany. Germany retaliated. Now remember, they blockaded Germany before the war, and they blockaded Germany after the war. This might give you a little hint of the deep resentment the German people had and why someone like Adolf Hitler could come to power. Germany retaliated in February 1915 by employing the submarine to blockade Great Britain. One policy was as legal as the other. Mr. Wilson protested, but neither side yielded. In no case in history has a nation at war observed the established rules if the rules conflict with military expediency. The United States has been no exception to this procedure, since the object of warfare is the physical destruction of an opponent. Once you justify the war, you must justify any means employed to gain the victory. In protesting to Germany, we argued that the submarines could not warn ships to take off passengers before they were sunk, but neither could the mines planted by Great Britain. American ships kept out of the mine zones but disregarded the submarine zones for reasons we shall later explain. The Lusitania, a British ship, was sunk by a submarine on May 7, 1915. 114 Americans lost their lives. We immediately protested, but the facts have shown that the Lusitania carried a large quantity of munitions of war. At the time the boat was sunk, a United States senator asked the Treasury Department for the bill of lading. He was told it had been turned over to the State Department. One of the most dangerous parts of our government is the State Department. When the senator asked the State Department for a copy of the bill of lading in order to see what was on board, the State Department refused to disclose the contents on the grounds that it was to be kept for diplomatic correspondence. It was not known till after the war was over what had actually been on board the ship. Since then, it has been officially stated by the Collector of Customs, then at the New York, that the Lusitania carried munitions of war. Besides, Germany had warned the passengers before getting on board that in all probability the ship would be sunk. This notice was officially published in the New York papers before the ship sailed. There's no question but that the passengers had been given due warning. Whether the sinking was legal or not depends on the point of view. According to Germany, she did more than the law required her warning before the ship left harbor, which is rather better than being warned a few minutes before being sunk in the mid-ocean. The British seized and searched the mails. United States officials below the rank of minister were searched by the British while traveling to and from the continent. Before the close of 1914, 31 cargoes of copper valued at $5,500,000 had been captured by Great Britain, but the United States owners were compensated. Their seizure, however, was illegal. Early in 1916, Germany agreed to give up the use of the submarine, but on condition that the United States make Great Britain obey international law. We could not force Great Britain to abide by international law, and consequently, Germany resumed her submarine warfare in 1917, which was our official reason for entering the war. But this was only our legal excuse. The effective causes were our economic ties with the Allies, the Allied propaganda in the United States. We will examine these causes more carefully. Modern warfare is a conflict of economic resources as well as armies. The British Navy cut off all economic intercourse between Germany and the United States. In this way, the economic resources of the United States were in the hands of the Allies. American agriculture, credit, and industry soon became the indispensability of the Allied cause. In 1915, an Anglo-French mission came to New York and secured a loan for $500 million. This money was left with various banks in New York for the purpose of buying supplies from America. The Allied governments continued to borrow in Wall Street, and these banks loaned England and France money with which to buy materials. Soon the House of Morgan became the purchasing agent of the Allies. The Morgan firm selected Edward R. Stettinus, president of the Diamond Match Company, as the purchasing agent. Mr. Stettinus selected 175 men to assist him in the task. They were soon purchasing supplies for the Allies at the rate of $10 million a day. By September 1917, the Morgan firm had purchased $3 billion in merchandise and munitions for the Allies, in addition to selling of Allied bonds. So the United States was firmly on the side of Germany's enemies way before the war. They did the same thing with Lend-Lease in World War II. The day the United States declared war against Germany, the British government's bank account with Morgan was heavily overdrawn. When Kitchener became Minister of War in Great Britain in 1915, one of the first acts was to cable Charles M. Schwab of Bethlehem Steel Company to come to England immediately. Schwab went and agreed to sell all the output of the Bethlehem Steel Company to the British government. In less than 2 years, he shipped about $300 million worth of war material to England. That's before there's even a declaration of war. And we did it in World War II, too. Like I say, we were up to our ears supporting the British against the Germans. 20 submarines were built and sent in parts to Canada, where they were assembled and sent across to England. This was done a year before the German submarine Deutschland came to the United States and was advertised as the first to cross the Atlantic. American industry had become one with the Allies. Our greatest banking and industrial institutions had become dependent upon an Allied victory, and an Allied victory was dependent upon them. American industry became pro-Ally because the British blockade cut off our trade with Germany. German and Austrian agents such as Dumba, Karl Boyed, and Franz von Papen were expelled from the country because of their unneutral activities on behalf of the Central Powers. Patriotic societies such as the Navy League, the American Defense Society, and the National Security League were all tied up financially with munitions plants. See, nothing changed. The Cheneys and all these guys, man, I mean, it's always the same, but yet the people stupidly go out and help them rob other countries or collect debts and so forth. It goes way back to the kings when the Jews would finance both sides, and whoever lost, they had to pay the money, or the Jews would take up the real estate and all that kind of stuff. These societies were propaganda bureaus for the preparedness, like us. See, we got, what, 2,000 ICBMs? We're in preparedness, which is very expensive to be in preparedness. And later, for our entrance into the conflict, the 19 men who founded the Navy League had among their numbers representatives of the three manufacturers of armor plate in America, the Midvale, Bethlehem, and Carnegie Steel Companies. The Navy League was in practice the propaganda bureau of the three companies working together to sell armor plate. See what I say? War is a racket. War is a goddamn racket. And whites agree to commit suicide all the time. Modern warfare has become even more than a conflict of armies and of economic resources. Propaganda to secure popular support has become more and more necessary. Both sides in the European conflict made great efforts to present their propaganda before America, but the Central Powers failed to primarily because of the British blockade. The Allies on their side had the cooperation of American business and easily accomplished their purpose. Professor Hayes, in his brief history of the Great War, says the British resorted to every known device of propaganda, from employing Secret Service agents in New York to maintaining at Washington the great journalist Lord Northcliffe with a host of assistants as a publicity director. These propagandists had the cooperation of the bankers who had made loans to the Allies or had acted as purchasing agents. All this happened in 1916, but the American people never knew the source of their war news until the conflict was over. Mr. Ratham, in the Providence Journal of Providence, Rhode Island, was notorious for his accounts of German crimes. Remember when they said Saddam Hussein, his men went into the nurseries there in Kuwait, took babies out and bashed them, killed them? Well, they said the same thing about the Germans in Belgium, that they were grabbing babies and bashing their brains out, which none of it was true. The Boston Herald of December 30th, 1923, in an editorial comment says, "It is, of course, true, as most well-informed people now understand, that the Wrotham disclosures, which made the Providence Journal famous during the war, were fiction. But Wrotham did this for the praiseworthy purpose of arousing his countrymen to war fury. He took one of the practical ways of doing so. See, this is the problem we've got with the news media today. The news media is extremely dangerous. And if it was possible at this time, it would be best to close it all down. You got it. I would cut off the free speech of corporate media. I'd reserve free speech for people who did not own big papers and big TV networks. But to keep from killing off more white people and plunging us into more wars, we'd have to shut down the main press in this country. Yes, I would. Captain Ferdinand Tui of the British Secret Service in the Secret Corps says, all the trickery and subterfuge and war wisdom of the ages brought up to date, intensified and harnessed to every modern invention and device, a Machiavelli, a Talleyrand, or some other master schemer of the age come back to earth, would have thrilled at the amazing cunning and corruption of it all. The Belgium authorities themselves have denied the truth of the crimes given out in the Bryce report. Mr. Lloyd George has stated in print that careful investigation disclosed that no case of Belgian children with hands cut off. Yet these are some of the crimes with which the American public were fed during 1916, 17, and 18. The peoples of the Central Powers were, of course, furnished similar crimes attributed to the Allies. There were many crimes committed, as in all wars, but every nation, including the United States, was guilty of them. It is not easy to explain the attitudes of many prominent officials of the United States during the years preceding our entrance into the war. Ambassador Walter H. Page, our representative in London, was guilty of direct disloyalty to the American government and people. When President Wilson protested to the British government against her disregard of neutral rights, Mr. Page did not give the messages to Sir Edward Grey of the British Foreign Office. He would read them to him and would then ask Grey to cooperate with him in making a reply to the United States. Sir Edward Grey says in his memoirs, quote, Page came to see me at the Foreign Office one day and produced a long dispatch from Washington contesting our claims to act as we were doing in stopping contraband and going to neutral ports. I am instructed, he said, to read this dispatch to you. He read and I listened. He then said, I have now read the dispatch, but I do not agree with it. Let us consider how it should be answered, unquote. In all diplomacy, there is no other example of such procedure. Page was determined upon our entrance from the very beginning of the war. Many of our representatives at the principal courts of Europe were connected with the Allies personally through business, or banking interests in this country. You get the message? You better. If you don't have the message by now, there's no hope for you. Mr. Wilson himself was pro-British in scholarship. He was a great admirer of the cabinet parliamentary form of government used in England. All his heroes in political science were English authorities. Mr. Wilson's former Attorney General, Thomas W. Gregory, says in a letter to the New York Times of February 9, 1925, that Wilson was the, by inheritance, tradition, and reasoning, at all times the friend of the Allies. Mr. Tumultrie also now says Wilson was never neutral. But he promised not to send your boys to war, just like Roosevelt promised not to send the boys to war in World War II. President Wilson had become converted to the idea of interventionism by the end of by the spring of 1916. Sir Edward Grey says in his memoirs that Colonel House, and you got to study more about House. He was a real snake in the grass who lived in the White House, just like that other guy did in World War II. Can't remember his name right off. assured him in February 1916 that Wilson would do his best to bring the United States to the aid of the Allies. In April 1916, the President consulted Champ Clark, Speaker of the House, Claude Kitchen, Democratic leader, H.D. Flood, Chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and other Democratic leaders regarding their willingness to bring the United States into the war on the Allies' side. This is known as the famous Sunrise Conference. They refused, and Mr. Wilson allowed his party to use the 1916 slogan, "He kept us out of the war." At the time, he was afraid to advocate intervention for fear of splitting his party. Here you go, party politics. There were demands on the part of the certain political leaders and the press for immediate intervention, but these demands were not representative of public opinion at the time. Ambassador Page brought his influence to bear on preventing the Allies from considering German proposals for peace offered in 1916 and 17. Allied propaganda represented Germany as lustful for world dominion, just like they did Germany in World War II. Hitler wanted to take over the world. Careful examination now shows that there was no such policy except that which is common to all powers. This was part of the false propaganda spread in the United States to inflame public opinion and make our entrance defensive, as they're doing right now. We're defending ourselves against terrorism by invading countries and occupying them all over the world to defend ourselves. it's so crazy. I mean, it's so crazy. Both sides resorted to trickery of every description. Much stir was created by a Zimmerman note published in March 1917. It was a proposal by Germany to Mexico to enter on the side of Germany should the United States join the Allies, with a view to recovering New Mexico and the surrounding territory taken by the United States from Mexico in 1848. But this was exactly what the Allies had done when they persuaded Japan to enter in order to capture the German sphere of influence in Shantung, China. It is obvious that every nation at war will try to weaken its opponent. We encouraged the Latin American republics to declare war on Germany, which was no more than Germany did in encouraging Mexico to declare war on the United States, should we declare war on Germany. This note was distorted and reported in 1917 in a manner to give the impression that Germany was actively trying to create trouble for the United States even in peace. The fact remains that the Zimmerman proposal was not to apply unless we entered the war against Germany, when it would be a legitimate defensive measure for Germany to secure the aid of Mexico. Brigadier General J.C. Charterius, Chief of Intelligence of the British Army during the war, stated boastfully in New York in an address in the fall of 1925 before the National Arts Club that he had invented the report that Germany... that Germany was boiling down the bodies of her dead soldiers to be used as fertilizer. He made the statement under the impression that no reporters were present. The Richmond Times-Dispatch on December 6, 1925 said editorially, quote, "Not the least of the horrors of modern warfare is the propaganda bureau, which is an important item in the military establishment of every nation. Neither is the least of the many encouraging signs which each year add to the probability of eventual peace on earth." Quote, the famous cadaver story, which aroused hatred against the Germans to the boiling point in this and other Allied nations during the war, has been denounced as a lie in the British House of Commons. Months ago, the world learned that the details of how this lie was planned and broadcasted by the efficient officer in the British Intelligence Service. Now we are told that imbued with the spirit of Locarno Pact, Sir Austen Chamberlain rose in the House and said that the German Chancellor had denied the truth of the story and that the denial had been accepted by the British government. quote, a few years ago, the story of how the Kaiser was reducing human corpses to fat aroused the citizens of this and other enlightened nations to a fury of hatred against Germany. Normally sane men doubled their fists and rushed off to the nearest recruiting sergeant based upon that crazy story. Now they are being told, in effect, that they were dupes and fools, that their own officers deliberately goaded them into the desired boiling point using an infamous lie to arouse them, just as a grown bully whispers to one little boy that another little boy said he could lick him. Quote, the encouragement sign found in the revolting admission of how modern war is waged is the natural inference that the modern man is not over-eager to throw himself at his brother's throat at the simple word of a command. His passions must be played upon, so the Propaganda Bureau has taken its place as one of the chief weapons. In the next war, propaganda must be more subtle, clever, than the best of World War produced. These frank admissions of wholesale lying on the part of trusted governments in the last war will not soon be forgotten. Well, they're doing it right now. They're lying all over the place about things that are going on in the Middle East, where the public doesn't really know what's happening, but the press is giving them mostly a colored false description, and their facts are not facts at all. After the United States entered the war in April 1917, we immediately created a government propaganda bureau, which was known as the Committee on Public Information, with George Creel as chairman. Since the war, Mr. Creel has given us an account of the propaganda activities in his book, How We Advertised America. Be interesting to get a hold of that book. No effort was made to present the truth. Allied propaganda was accepted, and to it we added ours. This Committee of Public Information issued 75,099,023 pamphlets and books to encourage the public morale, in other words, to hate the enemy, hate other white people. They hired the services of 75,000 speakers who operated in 5,200 communities. Those of you out there always saying the good old days when there was plenty of racism and the government all over the place. There may have been with the lowly Negro dirt farmer or whatever, but it sure wasn't that way when dealing with this kind of propaganda, which only caused hatred of Germans and back and forth all these countries of white people. Now, they had speakers who went from town to town speaking in 5,200 communities as propaganda to get people all whipped up for the war. Although about 755,190 speeches were made by these people, known as the Four-Minute Men, exhibits were given at fairs, and war films were prepared for the cinema, from which the Committee on Public Information received a royalty. A total of 1,438 drawings were employed to arouse popular hatred. I've got a lot of those in my library, especially World War II and the propaganda against the Japanese. An official daily newspaper was issued, which had a circulation of 100,000 copies. A propaganda bureau was established by the United States in the capitals of every nation in the world except those of the Central Powers. The total expenditure of the United States for propaganda was $6,738,223. See his book by George Creel, How We Advertised America, Chapter 1. This was the greatest fraud ever sold to the public in the name of patriotism and religion. The Espionage Act was passed, making it illegal to spread false reports that would hinder recruiting. Every report was false, which did not harmonize with the propaganda released by this Committee on Public Information. The best we can now say for Mr. Wilson and the American public is that they were victims of Allied propaganda and contributed to the wrecking of civilization. So there you go. That's the end of that. So why do we fall for this? I mean, you know how the right wing is always pro-war and all that. I remember when I first became a right winger back in the early 60s, I was a Yankee Doodle Dandy boy and went, let's go get them. And then Vietnam came along and I was totally pro-war. Let's go get them. It wasn't until I started getting more educated in the later 60s, early 70s, that I realized it was all a scam, because I was talking to Marines that were either going over to Vietnam or coming back, and I got the straight scoop. And we used to sit and have a beer down within about 5 blocks of my house. So I switched and became anti-war. Refused to pay my taxes. The IRS seized my house. That was long before Dees came along. But we managed to get the house back. And later, the feds tried to seize my house again. And luckily, there was a good friend of mine and an associate that bailed me out of that. So the third time was a charm when Dees and the boys seized the house. So it wasn't the first time. It was the third time. Anyhow, that's the way it goes, and if you know these facts, that these wars are put up jobs and millions of people die, millions of white people, white men mostly, who would be producing white kids into our population, and also all the white women that were murdered, killed by these different armies marching east and west and all that kind of stuff. And then the ripples go out even farther and farther to where has vast ramifications on civilians that are not even in the war. Loss of their husbands, all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, any good white racist separatist should be anti-war. And if you're not, you just don't understand what the hell is going on. And that's the end of that book, and I don't know whether we can get any more of them or not. I've got one extra one here. I could always photocopy the book. It's not a great big thick book. I hope you've got something out of this, because there's still all these right-wingers, a big bunch of them, that are pro-war. Or pro, let's go kill them all, you know. Let's go kill all the ragheads. Well, I'm not out to kill the ragheads. I'm on... leave them in peace in their countries. I don't want them coming here. I want them to go back home. And if we would quit raising hell through the corporations of tearing up countries, most of them would voluntarily go back home. You know? Like I've told you many times, a million, 2 million Nicaraguans up here. You know why they're here? Because Ronald Reagan and the boys went down there and tore their country to pieces, claiming they were fighting communism. People on both sides are killed all over the place. The people fled the country, get out of there, any place, just to get out of there. So they come here. And that was your good old Ronald Reagan and Colonel Oliver North, who should have both been in federal prison, if not executed. Put Oliver North on now. He's on television all the time as a big hero, just like they do Cheney. Yeah, they got him coming out of the woodwork advising how to fight the terrorists. In other words, invade other countries and occupy them. Onward and onward. War, 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 war. Never ends. Unless you want it to end. And if enough white people and other people in this country decide to end it, they should come together and forget a lot of other things and end it. The other problems we've got could be ironed out after that is ironed out.
A group of African American men is claiming that discrimination on a Sound Transit construction job was blatant and the worst they'd ever seen. Now they're suing the contractor who they claim was responsible. Como Force Tracy Vetter is live at Husky Stadium, where the light rail station is still under construction. Tracy?
Well, Eric, the construction group Trailer Brothers Kemper Frontier finished its work here more than a year ago, but the men who just filed their class action lawsuit say they are still waiting for justice. The joint venture construction group was responsible for building the light rail tunnel connecting Husky Stadium to Capitol Hill. The job broke ground in 2010, and the men filing the lawsuit, all experienced laborers, say they expected 2 years or more of steady work.
Good labor. Go to work every day, never late, always 30 minutes or an hour early, every day.
Instead, they say they were assigned menial tasks, such as picking up trash or watching electrical cords to see they didn't get tangled, and then fired within days.
It was horrible, being fired for some unknown reason.
Rashad Pearson says a foreman with a tattoo of a swastika on his hand fired him and the only other African American working the graveyard shift on the same day.
This was just blatant racism, and they didn't hide it at all.
Trailer Brothers, which managed the joint venture, denies the allegations. A statement from 2012 explained the hand tattoo as a Native American symbol, not a swastika, and said workers were dismissed either because they didn't have the necessary skills or were unsafe. But a Sound Transit investigation found that African American workers may have experienced discrimination and that they were three times likelier than Caucasians to either be fired or just not hired at all.
These are skilled, reliable, honest, hardworking men. These are good men. These are family men. These are men who wanted to work.
Attorney Stephen Teller says the class action suit isn't just about monetary compensation, but about preventing racial discrimination in the future. Attorney Teller believes that as many as 30 workers may have experienced discrimination here and could ultimately join the class action lawsuit. Reporting live at Husky Stadium, Tracy Vetter, Como 4 News.
Guess what, boys and girls? Partyism now trumps racism. If you're a Democrat, would you marry a Republican? Would you be upset if your sister did? Researchers have long asked such questions about race and have found that along important dimensions, racial prejudice is decreasing. At the same time, party prejudice in the U.S. has jumped, infecting not only politics but also decisions about dating, marriage, and hiring. By some measures, partyism now exceeds racial prejudice, which helps explain the intensity of some of the midterm election campaigns. There you go, boys and girls. You got to get back to work there. Well, it looks like the Leith, North Dakota people are whistling past the graveyard. They're patting themselves on the back for getting rid of Craig Cobb. A year ago, people could hardly believe their eyes seeing this tiny Grant County village. I wouldn't even count it as a village, filled with neo-Nazi commandos on one side, protesters on the other, and a squad of riot police between them. Today, but for a few faded red swastikas painted on dying trees behind his house, it's almost as if white supremacist Craig Cobb's short-lived takeover attempt never happened. Monday, the same date a year ago, the 300 protesters showed up to stand against Cobb's plans to take over the town government and open it to other racist sympathizers was, like then, the sweetest of September days. Golden trees and emerald green grass, arched by a brilliant blue sky, marked the same reason come once again. Season. With a notable difference, Cobb 62 is gone, marking parole on reduced terrorizing charges in another tiny North Dakota town near the Canadian border. Locked up and hope that the monitor he's wearing means he never returns, as he's been court ordered not to do. His much photographed house stands empty, the windows curtained over and some public health notices fading where they were taped to the glass. Oh boy. He might be about as far gone from Leith as North Dakota's geography can get him, but he's not forgotten. While Millie Feary, a local substitute teacher and preacher's wife, yeah, there you go, says she's glad for the peaceful days that contrasted a year ago. She says, not all is settled in Leeds. Quote, I tried to stay out of things. I still do. I hope there will be restorations, unquote. She said, sitting in her deck near the garden where zucchini plants show some damage from the frost, but still struggle on. The unsettling feeling has to do with the ongoing investigation into whether the city was legally within its rights to burn down a small house that Cobb had sold for $10,000 through the internet to a Wisconsin couple, Michael Benzie and his wife, Debbie Nelson. That was a year ago, back when Cobb first went public with his plans to make Leith a racial outpost for other racial supremacists and all the rest of the white people in town except the one black man. As part of his get-out-of-jail strategy following his arrest in November for terrorizing Leith residents during an armed patrol, Cobb deeded the couple's property and several other lots he still owned back to the city. The house had been condemned by Custer District Health and had not been occupied for 6 decades or more. Jeez, 60 years. Deed in hand, the city told Benzie and Nelson they would resell them the lots for $1, but the old house structure on it had to go. Everyone involved says that it was agreed on both sides, but Nelson said that later told Mayor Ryan Schock they'd changed their mind and didn't want to burn it down, as had been done with some other condemned properties in town. Nelson said that they still have a valid contract for the deed with Cobb, even though he didn't take payments after the town payment, and the city's ownership was subject to that deed. Schock said the couple knew the house was condemned, and he continued to tell them to remove anything from it before it was burned. You know, now, this house had sit there derelict for 60 years, and suddenly, because a Nazi came to town, they're going to burn it down. Oh, boy. Schock said the couple knew the house was condemned, and he continued to tell them to remove anything from it before it was burned. It was a condemned piece of property, no matter what the contract said. Why they don't understand, that's beyond me. For this and all that happened in the Cobb protests, arrest, and afterwards, Schock said the anniversary is not such a good day for him. It's been a hellish year, and I'm not going to lie about it, he said. Well, that's good that you're uncomfortable. Nelson said that they were unfairly painted with the same neo-Nazi brush because of bad timing, showing up in Leith to fix up one of Cobb's properties just when virtually all hell had broken loose. Meanwhile, they're fixing up another house a few doors down, and she said it's unclear how or if the other dispute will be resolved. She said it's doubly unfair because Cobb quit cashing their contract payments and wanted the house for white supremacists that would move to Leith to join his cause. We got screwed over by Cobb and the city. Both sides were trying to get us out, she said. We're constantly defending to people who are and who we aren't. Schock said the couple is making moves to buy another property in Leith, and it feels just like it did when Cobb was buying up vacant lots. The pattern's the same. They're trying to pull the wool over everybody's eyes, she said. Lee Cook, city councilman, said the city is being investigated by the Bureau of Criminal Investigation and has to turn over 2 years' worth of council minutes and financial statements. The ghost of Craig Cobb. He said no one on the city council has ever seen a complaint or really understand what's happening or why. He said he's angry that the state's attorney general's office refused to help Leith with the Cobb problem, but now the agency's investigating this obvious agreement that an old peace structure had to go. They, Benz and Nelson, agreed to it beforehand, he said. When he said the city would deed to them for $1 on the condition that the house be removed, Benz said he didn't need to think about it, Cook said. Even so, when Cook and Schock brought in equipment and burned the house 3 months ago, the couple called the Grand County Sheriff Department and made a complaint. Sheriff Steve Bay said the investigation continues, but not through his office. The BCI does not confirm or deny the investigation. It looked like the mayor of Leith may go to jail. karma, karma, karma. Bay said the anniversary of the protest in Leith snuck up on him. Without being reminded of the date, he wouldn't have given it much thought. The whole situation cost Grant County taxpayers in the state $10,000s in jail costs. Public defenders for Cobb and his terrorizing cohort, Keenan Dutton, armed police assistants during the rally, inspections of Cobb's property, frequent police summons to Leith, and the list goes on. It cost them a bundle, man. Again, the ghost, not the ghost, but the karma of Craig Cobb. Bay said he hasn't heard a thing since Cobb was released on a plea deal and moved to Sherwood near the Canadian border. I want Cobb out of the state and on probation in another state, Bay said. Meanwhile, it's quiet in Leith, and Bay said his office has only had two or three calls there in the past half year. Cook said, aside from being on guard when the new vehicles rolled through the town, he's feeling more relaxed, though he's planning to upgrade his outdoor security cameras and still keeps a gun loaded. Quote, there is joy to actually living here and not fighting the Nazi Brigade every day, he said. The Cooks live kitty-cornered from Cobb's former residence and had a front-row seat to the swastika flags and neo-Nazi sympathizers coming and going, some moving in and at least one other setting up a tent. Within 2 months of making his stand, Cobb, along with Dutton, were arrested for carrying armed weapons through the town. Of course, that should not be illegal at all. And then they say and threatening Lee Cook and others, including Miller and Paul Ferry. Cobb was released in April after pleading guilty to mostly reduced charges and one felony, terrorizing. Well, I watched the video of the whole parade through the town. I didn't see Cobb or his buddy point a gun at anybody, let alone threaten them. Heather Cook said she'll never feel completely safe as long as she lives in Leith. And she said their children will duck out of sight when someone comes into town they don't recognize. Quote, I feel safe until someone drives through, she said. Quote, I don't feel it will be totally over as long as we live in the town. Gee whiz. Well, I sent Lauren Donovan a little note. She wrote this letter for the Billings Gazette. And I said, well, Craig Cobb's gone, but I'm not. I may disagree with his tactics, but I don't disagree with his right to live and leave. But come spring, we'll see what happens. Yeah, Tommy may drop in, say hello. He's the son of Hitler's brother. Now his diaries have allegedly been discovered over in jolly old England. He was an English citizen, Andrew Hitler, and actually I guess during the war went over there and got treated and feeded quite a bit by Hitler, but then they went back and ran out on him to England. I guess he died there, but now they allegedly have found his diaries. There's quite a bit of it on the internet if you want to find it.
Hello! Hello!
Hello! Who is this?
It is King Arthur, and these are my knights of the Round Table. Whose castle is this?
This is the castle of my master, Guido de Luamba.
Go and tell your master that we have been charged by God with a sacred quest. If he will give us food and shelter for the night, he can join us in our quest for the Holy Grail.
Well, I'll ask him, but I don't think he'll be very keen. He's already got one, you see.
What?
He said they've already got one.
Are you sure he's got one?
Oh, yes, it's very nice.
I told him we already got one.
Well, can we come up and have a look?
Of course not. You are English types, sir.
Well, what are you then?
I'm French. Why do you think I have this outrageous accent, you silly king? What are you doing in England? Mind your own business.
If you will not show us the Grail, we shall take your castle by force.
You don't frighten us, English pig dogs. Go and boil your bottom, sons of a silly person. Ah, blow my nose at you, so-called Afer King. You and all your silly English kniggets.
What a strange person.
Now look here, my good man.
I don't want to talk to you no more, you empty-headed animal food trough whopper. I fart in your general direction. Your mother was a hamster, and your father smelt of elderberries.
Is there someone else up there we can talk to?
No. Now go away, or I shall taunt you a second time.
Now this is your last chance. I've been more than reasonable.
Fetch in a mush.
What? Fetch in a mush.
If you do not agree to my commands, then I shall...
Jesus Christ!
Right.
The meaning of life. To the council of ease, this is the meaning.